Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Eugenics. It's from the Greek. It means good and born. When you put them together, good offspring. The practice of eugenics dates back to the turn of the 20th century, and it's one of the darker chapters in American history.
The only thing I remember is that they put me on the hospital there, you know, and the nurse told me to sing her song, you know, and I don't know what song I was singing, nothing like that. All I know is she put that mask over my face, and that was it.
The compulsory sterilization of men and women deemed undesirable to society took place in more than 30 states throughout the 20th century. It was practiced mostly on poor and disenfranchised men, women, and children. A new documentary out this weekend called The State of Eugenics explores the history and uncovering of state-sponsored eugenics in North Carolina. It also spends time with the victims, many of whom survive today, since eugenics was practiced well into the 1970s. Dawn Sinclair Shapiro is the filmmaker of The State of Eugenics. She says the eugenics practices in North Carolina, once buried deep in state archives, were policy at one time and publicly promoted.
When it comes into existence in the late 20s and early 30s, there's propaganda across the state about the new pseudoscience of eugenics, and we have eugenic sterilization law, and we're really going to try and champion this belief system that we can better the human gene pool by weeding out, if you will, the unfit. And that is what is referred to as negative eugenics. Positive eugenics starts in the UK in the 1880s, comes across the pond, and it's more about just promoting childbirth amongst the good stock. But somehow when it gets here to the US, it takes on a negative bent that is really about stopping certain groups of people from procreating. And North Carolina at the time, before World War II, is really focusing on kind of poor whites, men and women, and people in institutions. But essentially, after World War II is when it becomes so much more sinister, because it is literally targeting not just race purification, if you will, but people who are outside what the upper crust believed was the good people in society.
So we're talking about, at the time, people who would have been called feeble-minded. That was a popular phrase. People who had awkward social habits. I would imagine people who cross-dressed or were even gay or lesbian, they were probably candidates. What other types of people are we talking about? And I assume that this didn't happen to rich people.
Exactly. The perpetrators were pretty much targeting the poor, the marginalized, no one who was essentially a voting bloc. But then you see, because it lasted for so many decades, the social mores of the time, you see single mothers are really being sought out as, you know, they are really bad and they're going to bring our country down, these single women having children out of wedlock. The goal was to really get into people's homes and to sterilize their entire families. There's a case in our film, Dorothy Mae Grant is a survivor. There's a dossier that she and I go through in 2011 where they tried to sterilize not only she and her siblings, but her cousins and second cousins, anyone related to her.
Let's hear from Dorothy Mae Grant.
When I had my sterilization, I was in this room right here. We'd done what we was told, and that was it. I mean, you didn't argue about it. You didn't fuss about it. It was just the way things were. I didn't want to have the surgery, but it wasn't nothing I can do about it because the papers was already signed.
So how did it happen in North Carolina when somebody was, I'll say, targeted for forced sterilization? Were they outed or volunteered by their neighbors? Did the state come after them? How did it work?
All those things, actually. It had both a top-down and sort of a bottom-up, if you will. From the top-down, you have this entity called the North Carolina Eugenics Board, and it was comprised of five members who met monthly, and they were typically the head or the deputy head of a state agency, and they would review a paragraph of a petition for sterilization for an individual in North Carolina, and then they would essentially rubber stamp that to put them into the pipeline for sterilization. But then if you take the petitions, and where are those coming from? If you go to the very local level, it can come from a community member who will approach a sheriff, perhaps, or a physician in the community, a social worker in the community. And then it comes through the social welfare at times, where you have social workers who really work to try and get their entire caseload sterilized.
So on the one hand, there's this idea of social engineering, biological engineering. There's a racial component, the state going after people, people being nominated by their neighbors. It smacks of kind of right-wing race engineers, people who you might have expected in Nazi Germany. But one of the things that was shocking in your film is that in the earlier days of eugenics, this was very much a hallmark of progressives, of people who viewed themselves as champions of the poor.
The 1927 Buck v. Bell Supreme Court decision is where we see this intersection of the progressive movement taking thought and belief systems.
And we should say that that's the Supreme Court decision that ruled that eugenics laws were constitutional, basically clearing the way in the states.
Exactly, making it the law of the land. And it comes in the decision, and it talks about the public health movement and the state's interest in compelling and forcing people to be inoculated.
Don Sinclair Shapiro, at the time that eugenics became popular, it was really appealing. People supported this in most places. This was not just North Carolina. And I was surprised to learn it was largely out of anxiety and fear of immigration. And hearing that fact now, given the public debate and fears over immigration now, it was a little bit chilling to see.
I say in the last few weeks, that's been one of the other main takeaways, is the anti-immigration rhetoric that informs the 1924 Immigration Restriction Act. And Harry Laughlin from the Eugenics Record Board Office, whose job when it was established in 1910 was to work on multiple fronts about promoting eugenics around the country and getting to the eugenic sterilization laws, and they take extreme views on immigrants and particularly really wanted to stop Southern Italians and Eastern European Jews. And he testifies in front of Congress in 1924, and that influences the decision. When we take a look at our discussions around immigration today, literally, and in these coming months, one of the things that might even be chilling to hear is Calvin Coolidge, on signing the act, says, America must remain American. So
Sounds familiar.
And so not to conflate, right, or draw direct parallels, but I think we would be remiss to not take the fact that we have a very cautionary tale in terms of the history of a movement, eugenics, how it led to not only the sterilization abuse that we are confronted with today with living survivors, but how it worked to dehumanize and to prevent people from not just coming to the country, but living lives here and not have to experience marginalization and this idea of being an other.
The film is The State of Eugenics. It's the story of decades of eugenics and forced sterilization policy in the state of North Carolina, only one state among at least 30 that had legalized sterilization from the 1920s, in many cases through the 1970s. Don Sinclair Shapiro is the filmmaker. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
The documentary is The State of Eugenics. It premieres this Sunday on the World Channel and local public television stations across the country.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.